Hello, and welcome to this episode of Explore Cell Therapy. In this podcast, we explore practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies through conversations with transplant centers and hematology oncology practices. I'm Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. For this episode, I sat down with Dr. Fred Applebaum of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center and Dr. Courtney Belomo of New York Oncology Hematology to discuss the evolution of transplant over time. We explore how clinical practice is constantly changing in this rapidly evolving field, and how transplant centers and hematology oncology practices can work together to close gaps in provider understanding that ultimately lead to gaps in patient access to potentially life-saving treatment options. To read their full bios and access additional resources related to today's episode, follow the link in the episode description. This is the final part of a three-part discussion. Thinking a little bit in this whole discussion, obviously the field is changing rapidly all the time, whether we're talking in decades or a matter of a few years. And you've both referenced different gaps that you've seen that where the research and advances haven't quite made it into the perceptions or fully into practice, whether that's on the transplant center side or the hematology oncology side. So I'm just curious if you could each speak a little bit to what you see as the most prevalent or in some cases detrimental misperceptions about transplant among physicians on both ends of the spectrum.
Why don't you go first, Courtney?
Yeah, so I think you actually can't answer that question without talking about CAR T, because I think that that is changing the conversation for a lot of community oncologists. I think because everybody knows that it's out there and that it's out there for lymphoma and even myeloma, I think it makes some things where we would have considered an allo before, like in CLL and things like that. It's pushing that conversation further back. And I think it's a little bit probably making people frustrated that we haven't pushed it further in AML or even in adult ALL yet. And so I actually think that the biggest gap is actually who's eligible for a transplant. You would think that that would not be the biggest gap because we've spent years talking about who's eligible, but it's still... With all of the next generation sequencing and all of these like hundreds of genes you need to know now, I think for the general oncologist to tease out when to refer someone for MDS, when to refer someone for myelofibrosis, even the leukemia specialist, how to interpret all of these different genetic studies that are coming out so rapidly. The gap is still, when do you refer? When is it time to refer? And I think when any of my colleagues ask me, the answer I always say is early. What's the worst that happens? Nobody gets a transplant? Like, it's always better earlier. And so I still think the biggest gap is that for physicians is that we close the door to a conversation because we think we know the answer, instead of maybe asking the transplanter what the answer is. So what I mean by that is we say, nope, someone's 72, door closed. Nope, their MF has been fine, door closed. Nope, I'm not entirely, I'm a little confused about this genetic study. I'm going to watch them for another few months. Nope, door closed. And so that, I think, is the biggest physician gap. And then if the physician's not on board with that amount of buy-in, the patient gaps become bigger. Because it's not just the psychosocial, it's about the person that you've had a relationship with for 5 years or who got you through induction, even though you've only known them for 4 weeks, you building that trust and then us sending you somewhere else because the person you trust is saying, actually, you need someone better than me, My answer is, I don't know what the right answer is, and kind of rebuilding that trust. And if the physician doesn't have buy-in, neither does the patient. I don't know if that's a long-winded answer to that question, I guess.
No, I think it's a good answer. I agree. First of all, there's enormous variability among the level of training and knowledge among different providers. And I don't mean this may sound critical, and I don't mean that. I cannot imagine going out and trying to be a solo practicing hematology oncology person, or just being in a very small practice with one or two people. I can hardly imagine being a person who just deals with hematologic malignancies. We become more and more subspecialized, so you know more and more about less and less until you know practically everything about nothing. But really, to try and be competent in taking care of breast cancer and lung cancer with all the subtypes, and at the same time know enough about leukemia, it's unimaginable. So there are levels of differences throughout the communities. I think among the providers who perhaps have less up-to-date knowledge, I think the biggest problems we see are that, as Courtney said, they may think that a patient is not a candidate because of age. They may think a patient is not a candidate because of donor availability. Those are two. And then the other is that they don't get all the molecular testing that is required to say that they are necessarily a candidate, and therefore they may not refer patients in a timely fashion. And so I just want to reiterate what Courtney said, and that is refer. As you say, the worst thing that can happen is another set of eyes looks at the patient and confirms what you think or gives you a new insight. What's the matter with that? Who doesn't want more knowledge in taking care of a patient? Who's harmed by that?
Well, and I also think too is it's so interesting to me that is a barrier, because most of us are comfortable getting second opinions all the time. How is this any different? It's just, I think, because you have to set the stage with the patient about, hey, look, if you walk down this road, there are going to be other things that you need to do to walk down it. But really, me sending someone to your level of expertise, it's just me sending it to a second opinion. And I will say to patients, I said, I don't think we really have a hierarchy in oncology, but if you want a second opinion, like, there are people who only do lymphoma, who only do leukemia. That's who we should get you to, because as you kind of need a second opinion, let's go up a step in knowledge base, recognizing to my partners, hey, my patient just popped up with breast cancer. One of you are going to have to take that, because I don't know how to do that anymore. I feel like the best three words that we know as physicians is, I don't know. It's okay for us to say we don't know. Let's get you to someone who does.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, for sure. And, I'm hearing the big theme is refer early, refer often. If you're unsure, refer. But in terms of, trying to sort of ensure that those practice changes and that eligibility criteria is well understood by physicians, do either of you have any recommendations as to how we can try to improve those processes and sort of empower physicians in the referral process?
Well, I'll say one thing. I think that there are a number of organizations, including the NCCN and the ELN, who spend a lot of time and effort and thought in developing guidelines. And these guidelines are very, very useful. They're readily accessible. They're free. And I think that those should be on most people's fast dial and readily available. And I think that the NMDP has done similar things as far as donor availability and transplant eligibility. So those things, a lot of effort has gone into those, and those should be made as readily available as possible.
I also think, too, as the community provider, I think it's so important to build relationships with your major centers in the area. So I think it makes a huge difference that I can email, you know, Rob Soifer at Dana-Farber and say, hey, I'm trying to decide what to do about induction or palliative treatment. And I have a guy that has this, this, and this, and his, you know, his echo shows this. My inclination is to say he's not going to be a transplant candidate, but would you agree? So I think that if you, it's about, you know, to Dr. Applebaum's point, it's about access. So if we have access to all these criteria and there are clear, you know, this person is in the box, it's clear that they would not be eligible. But for the nuance, for the people you don't know, the other part of that access is actually access to your local transplanters. So making sure that in the world of cell phones and email, I think we have access to one another as long as we work on building those relationships. And I think that that needs to happen on both sides. I think most transplant centers do a fair amount of outreach, and it's about, it's maybe not, maybe you're giggling at that.
Oh, no, just the opposite. I was just going to say, Courtney, it was really funny. There's a group of us, and it includes Rob and Joe Anton from, and Mick Jones from, yeah. I mean, there's like 20 of us on this one email string, and we'll say, hey, have you seen this? And right. within a minute, you'll get 8 responses. It is a community of physicians who have grown to respect and enjoy each other, and are more than happy to deal with these hard problems. It really is amazing, and it's actually a lot of fun.
I think that that's part of why a lot of us got into medicine. We enjoy human interaction. I'd like to think so anyway, if we're sitting in front of patients all day. So I do think people enjoy that kind of collaboration. Our practice is part of US Oncology. So we have the same sort of thing with our hematology research group. People post up a question, someone sends an article, somebody else sends it. I feel like not only, even if I'm not the one posing the question, I learn so much just reading those threads of what other people are doing. So you're constantly having, you know, the most up-to-date data in front of you. And so to have that easy access where I can just email someone and ask a question, I think it makes so much different. And more than anything, it fosters trust. So if we are really pushing towards, you know, especially in the post-COVID or, I don't know, intra-COVID world, pushing towards patients wanting to be home, wanting to be with their family, wanting to have access to things from their own home, then that means that there has to be trust with the community providers. There has to be trust in the transplant providers. So those small communications start to build that trust and build what shared care really looks like. Because most people either can't be in Seattle constantly or want to be in their home. And how do we build that so that we work as one big brain? Because I think that also gives patients comfort to know, you know what, when you show up at Dr. Soifer's office, he's going to know me, and he's going to talk about that. No, you should trust Dr. Bellomo. And when you show up in my office, I'm going to sing Dr. Soifer's praises, and we're going to talk about why you should trust him. And that makes a huge difference for a patient who has to see multiple providers. They don't want to be in the one in the middle trying to figure out a problem. They want us to do it, to tell them why. It's not that they don't want to be involved in the conversation, but they don't want to say, well, you know, Dr. Applebaum says X and Dr. Bellomo says Y. Who am I supposed to listen to?
Yeah. And I don't want to stray from the conversation, but I think that is more important now than it's ever been before, for lots of reasons.
No, I wholeheartedly agree. People want us to talk to one another. And I think that that is honestly the basis of expectations.
And I think that patients are more willing to trust their primary physicians than a stranger. And it all gets down to trust in science and medicine. That's really important.
Well, and I also think too, is, you know, I have a patient, not a transplant patient, but he's got cancer. His wife has cancer. They're trying to get her out to a second opinion in Boston, but due to his cancer, he can't drive. She's too sick too. And I had to have a whole conversation just to deal with the panic attack about them getting on a train and that they weren't going to get COVID. There's so much of that anxiety and panic. So the more that we can do close to home, that is reasonable. I think it's very important for community providers to say when. Like, there are times when I've emailed out to Dana-Farber or said to a patient who was, I remember a specific instance where I said to a patient who was following at Sloan and looked and said, look, Albany's not the right place for you. You have to go there. I do not have the capability to get the answers that you need so that we can make you better. I know you don't want to go to New York, but you need to get in a car and you need to get in a car now. So it's important to know your limits, but then to also build that trust for the easy stuff so that patients can be close to home. And then little by little, that autonomy is kind of graded and earned.
Yeah. All right. And so you're presenting that coordinated shared care team effort to the patient, that the patient is seeing you as one care team on their side.
Yeah.
As opposed to these separate entities. It's huge. Wonderful. All right. So let's talk a little bit about things that you're excited about for the future of transplant and stem cell therapy. Thinking through some of the latest trends and things that we've talked about today, what does the next generation of transplant and cell therapy look like to you?
I'll talk about one issue. Probably the thing that is the most heartbreaking. I mean, if the two biggest barriers to transplantation are disease recurrence and chronic graft versus host disease. Those are the two things that everything else I wouldn't say we've entirely solved everything else, but most other things have become very low. I mean, as I said, our non-relapse mortality rate during the first 6 months now is less than 7 or 8%. So it's getting better, better, better. Chronic GVHD can be a devastating disease. It's worse in some cases than the disease the patient started with. But there are, I think that we're getting better and better at that. And two approaches, I think, have been the therapies that, as I was joking about, that Rick Jones and the group at Johns Hopkins helped develop, which is the post-transplant Cytoxan, which has been very effective in decreasing both acute and chronic graft versus host disease. And then we at the Hutch with Marie Bleakley have developed a technique of being able to take the stem cell product, and in animal models, it's quite clear that graft versus host disease, and particularly chronic graft versus host disease, arises from naive T cells. And when people have done total T-cell depletion, which was really pioneered by Rick O'Reilly and the group at Sloan Kettering, they were very effective in getting rid of graft versus host disease, but they had a high incidence of post-transplant viral infections, EBV infections, and other problems, including relapse. And so what Marie's been able to do is to segregate out the naive T cells, which are responsible for graft versus host disease, from memory T cells, which are the ones that provide early immune reconstitution. And so you do not get any EBV or CMV or other problems because you're giving back the memory T cells that fight those. We've now done, and she has a second paper coming out on this. We've done over 150 patients with this approach. And our incidence of of extensive chronic graft-versus-host disease is virtually zero. And that is just astounding. It's 2 or 3%. And so I think these are two approaches. Now, we have to compare them both, see which one's better. And so we're doing that randomized trial right now, comparing naive T-cell depletion to post-transplant cytoxin to see which one's going to prove better. But I think those are both incredibly exciting approaches that can, you know, just make transplantation so much more palatable and acceptable to the patient and to the referring physician as well. I mean, when you send a patient and you know you're going to get them back and they're not going to be troubled with chronic graft-versus-host disease, that changes your perception of transplantation by quite a bit.
Well, I think then you're almost looking at training people how to do post-auto care, which is really so much different, allows people to get back so much faster. And even I think, you know, when I trained, I think we were starting to use Rituxan, but not that much. And then we were certainly not using Jakafi yet and Rebazil and all these other things. And so the fact that those things are even out there and seeing how those are changing to know that there's something coming that takes that piece away, because I think that's a little bit of the hard sell. And it's also, I think, really hard to explain it to patients of what it is. And then when it happens to them, they look at you like, why? Why would you let me do this sometimes? Yeah. Because it can be so horrible. So that's really exciting.
And then the other one is disease recurrence, which is, at the end of the day, the big one. And I think Courtney already talked a little bit about how we are learning how to integrate new therapies, including CAR T cells, into the transplant regimens. It's not a battle. They're not autologous transplant or allogeneic transplant and CAR Ts are not at war with each other. They are both effective, and our job is learning how to integrate the two to get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, at an affordable price and with access for patients, right? So with side effects profiles that are appropriate and how do you change cellular therapy products, whether it be NK or CAR T or allogeneic T cell, so that they are very much more like an autologous, you know, outpatient program. So the initiation of some of these products where your cytokine release syndrome and your neurotoxicity are less than 50%, and could you do them as an outpatient? And I think what's so interesting is that as this field grows, so is the field of telemedicine, wearables, the IT, so that the tech is hitting, I think, the ground at the same time that these therapies are. And so it really lends the idea of what does it look like if you can send someone home with like an Apple Watch that tells you when their heart rate's high and who has to monitor that and can they be at home? And so it really, I think that's what's going to change the paradigm. And, you know, to your point, Fred, in agreement with you, it's not such a big deal to say, well, I've got three choices. What do I choose? Like, that's not a bad thing. That's an exciting thing to have rather than you're not an identical twin. I'm sorry, we don't have options for you. So it's really exciting to talk about and I think it's also, it brings up so many really fascinating questions about, you know, when do we do these therapies? Like, you know, if we do them, patients have asked me, well, why don't I just do CAR T first line? Why do I need to do R-CHOP? Well, because, you know, and then you have to explain the cost, the financial toxicity. So to have all these options, to figure out how to sequence them, to constantly make them better, it just means that people get to live longer. Because even, you know, even to your story about Laura Graves, 2 years with her family is not nothing. It's a lot, actually. And so how do you, you know, the things that we do, if they allow you to have independence and quality of life, those are things we can't typically measure in data, no matter how many surveys we figure out how to. It's hard to measure, but it's important.
Absolutely. You know, I just to your point, I Bob Graves was asked about the transplant and was asked, would you do it again? And he said, in a heartbeat. So to just answer your question. The other area that is really, I think, exciting is the new gene therapies, which are built on the backbone of autologous transplantation. You know, the very first patient in the world that was ever cured of sickle cell disease was a young girl who had AML and had a transplant for sickle cell. That transplant was performed, I think, in 1981. I may be off by a few years. I just talked to her on the phone last month. She's alive and well. I was able to live her dream of starting two daycare centers as the head. And she said, you know, she taps herself on the shoulder every once in a while and says, am I still really here? You know, it's amazing. But transplantation for sickle cell has taken a long time to become prevalent. It still is just touches the teeniest percentage of patients that need it. Same thing for thalassemia. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of kids that are born every year with these diseases. But what's really, and transplantation has cured these diseases, which were never curable before. But what's really incredible now are these data that suggest that with the new technologies, you can take bone marrow from a patient with sickle cell disease or thalassemia. You can remove the bone marrow, and using gene therapy, you can replace an abnormal beta globin gene with a normal one, treat the patient with busulfan, do an autologous transplant, and seemingly cure their disease. And this has now been, it's now licensed in Europe for thalassemia. It's the first gene therapy that's been licensed. That is extraordinary, just extraordinary that we'll be able to do that. It's now been done for a storage disease. In fact, you know, we can imagine that almost any monogenic disease, this is going to, that's blood-based, this is going to be possible. Now, there's a lot of detail that still have to be worked out to make sure about its safety and efficacy. But my goodness, can you imagine that we'll be able to cure sickle cell and thalassemia this way? It's just mind blowing.
And it's also too is, you know, you first and foremost, obviously the impact to that patient. But when you think of all the other ways that one of those patients utilizes the healthcare system. So whether it be transfusions in the setting of how many blood bank shortages with COVID, right? The way that vaso-occlusive crisis lands people in the hospital and it gives them financial toxicity. It causes them to sometimes lose jobs, their walk around in pain, like all those impacts, but also not having such a stressed healthcare system with people in the hospital. I'm not in any way suggesting that if you need blood or the hospital, you shouldn't go, because you should. But if you start to think about these diseases, how to cure them early, it is not just an impact to that one patient, to that family. It's just a huge impact. It's like throwing a boulder in a lake rather than skipping a stone. It makes such a difference. It's amazing.
I talked to Kimberlyn George is the name of the patient. And I asked her, what does she remember about her childhood? And she says, the only thing she remembers is pain. That's all she remembers, that she would have sickle crisis after sickle crisis. And just, that's all she remembered was pain. And now after the transplant, she was cured. So, and now we have better ways of doing that. And Courtney's right. It's the impact it's going to be just enormous.
It really changes. And it's very interesting, because I think what you will end up seeing as an adult hematologist is I will not end up seeing these patients. They will just slowly fade because they'll have this when they're kids. And they'll get to run like everybody else. And they get to fall in love like everybody else. And it's not with this whole lens and blanket of pain that I think they really suffer through. Yeah. And so it's amazing as a concept. You know, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm extremely excited about CAR T and cellular therapies, but right now they're still only working 40% of the time, which means 60% of the time they're not. And so when you, I think, do one of these therapies, and I'm sure you feel this way, Fred, when you do a transplant, you know, even if you're buying them 6 months, you're buying them 12 months, that's a huge impact. So the idea that you're giving them back a whole life, I can't even wrap my head around that.
Yeah. Yep.
So exciting.
That's really amazing. It's beautiful to think about. All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much. And I do want to mention, Dr. Applebaum, I don't know if you wanted to say anything. I believe you're working on a book. Am I correct on the history of transplant?
Yeah, it's going to be published by Mayo Clinic Press. It's a combination of a biography of Don Thomas, as well as a story of how transplantation came to be. It has my editor is still not through the publication date, but we'll let you know.
Wonderful. Well, yeah, I'm very excited to read it. I'm sure Dr. Palomo is too.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, again, thank you both so much for joining me today. It was a true pleasure taking this sort of journey with you through transplant and looking into the future. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you for having us. This was fun.
Thanks again for joining me today. For more information and access to resources and research referenced throughout today's episode, be sure to click the link in the episode description. See you for the next installment of the Explore Cell Therapy podcast.